This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The Federal Reserve names names of those who borrowed during the crisis.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning. I'm Steve Chiatakis. In a little more than an hour, the Federal Reserve will release the names of banks that borrowed money during the financial crisis from something called the discount window. More now from Marketplace's Jennifer Collins.
Maybe you've heard the Fed called the lender of last resort. When a bank has no other option, says University of Chicago professor Anil Kashyap, it shows up at the Fed's discount window.
The discount window has historically been the place that you would go in the United States if you're a bank to temporarily borrow.
But going to the window comes with a stigma, kind of like eating at a soup kitchen.
That led people not to want to use it very much, even if they might have needed to.
And in 2008, a lot of banks needed money, and fast. The Fed kept their names quiet to get them to take the cash. Morris Davis is an economics professor at the University of Wisconsin.
I would not be surprised to see every major market participant either voluntarily or been forced to take some of these loans.
The names on the list today may look familiar, and expect to see more reports like this. New financial regulations require the Fed to disclose the names of visitors to the window after a two-year lag. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Well, 8 days and counting to the next budget deadline in Washington. And if Congress doesn't act before April 8th, a week from tomorrow, then the government will shut down. Late yesterday, Vice President Joe Biden met with Senate Democratic leaders and said a showdown could be averted. Marketplace Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is with us live right now. Good morning, John.
Hey, Steve.
I thought this shutdown was a real possibility. Why the sudden optimism?
Well, the Democrats are grasping at a pretty thin straw. Yesterday afternoon, Vice President Biden met with Senate Democrats, and they agreed to cut $33 billion from the current year budget. That's a big amount, probably the largest domestic spending cuts in history, but still only half the cuts that are called for in the House Republican budget. And Republicans are saying this morning it's not enough. So while Democrats claim they've achieved the outlines of a compromise to keep the government going, Republicans say not so fast.
All right. So what were the cuts in the Democrats' plan?
Well, we don't know. The hard choices haven't been made. It kind of shows the bleakness of the political stalemate we've come to when the mere agreement on a level of cuts without any of the details is touted as a breakthrough. There's still a real long way to go before Democrats and Republicans can shake hands on a deal.
What has to happen, John, to avoid a government shutdown?
Well, if this really is an agreement, the Democrats have to deliver and pass them in the Senate. The Senate plan would have to be compromised with the House plan, and that calls for $60 billion in spending cuts before Congress can send any final package to the president. It's really a tall order with only a little over a week to go.
Yeah, clock is ticking. All right, Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington. John, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Let's do the numbers. European stocks are mixed right now. Oil is back up to more than $105 a barrel in trading after forces loyal to Muammar Gaddafi seized an important Libyan oil port today. Wall Street yesterday, the Dow added 71 points to close at 12,350.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Allianz, insuring more than 75 million customers worldwide and providing retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. By Chevrolet, undertaking a carbon-reducing effort, investing in projects like wind farms and planting trees across America over the next few years. ChevyCarbonReduction.com. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733.
At baseball stadiums across the country today, fans will be rooting for the home team. In Tampa, Florida, that team is the Rays, and for years they were losers of games and of money. But a new book chronicles how the team's owners, former big bankers, turned it all around. Jonah Carey wrote, "The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team from Worst to First." Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You write about the Tampa Bay Rays and how they gave teams with big payrolls a run for their money. This sounds a lot like Moneyball, right? The book where the Oakland A's figured out some of the stats that were undervalued and then exploited that. How are the Rays different?
I think it's a little bit more nuanced. It's being 2% better than the competition in everything that they do. That's what their owner, Stuart Sternberg, who comes from Goldman Sachs, that's his belief. So we're talking about everything from signing players to contracts below market value, hiring a better manager, to marketing, and how are their ushers, and should they have more post-game concerts than the next guy? They're really thinking about things from that perspective. It's a more holistic approach, I would say, and again, a more subtle approach.
How did the owners of the Rays figure out the keys to financial and on the field success?
They came in and said, "Hey, you know, we come from the world of Wall Street. There are things that are applicable that can work out." And so one of the lessons that they took to heart was something called arbitrage. On Wall Street, it's taking two similar assets. You're buying one, you're selling the other, and you're benefiting. You're getting a little bit of a profit. And so in baseball terms, the general principle is the same. You're making this small little deal for a utility infielder or a B-level prospect or a relief pitcher. These pieces that don't seem all that huge, but collectively they add up to a whole lot.
I want to talk about the institution of baseball and how it became this game of teams that are winners because they have money and teams that are losers because they don't. The first thing that comes to mind for me are the Yankees, right?
It's always been that way. It's just that as more revenue has come into the game, the gulf has widened. That's why it's so compelling. In 2008, the Tampa Bay Rays had a $43 million payroll. Red Sox were about $140 million, and the Yankees were about $210 million, five times more than the Rays. Rays knocked them off anyway. That is a compelling underdog story. You are beating the biggest, baddest teams in the sport. And then they did it twice in 3 years. They came back and did it again in 2010.
Jonah Carey, author of The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team from Worst to First. It was fun. Thank you, Jonah.
Thank you.
And finally, some customers to a New York City restaurant got all angry over an extra charge that appeared on their bill for ice. Apparently, the bar at the Darby tacks on $2 for each drink served on the rocks. The manager told the website Eater.com a lot of places, that his bartenders pour more alcohol in those drinks. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. Online at marketplace.org, this is the Marketplace Morning Report. And this is APM, American Public Media.
The Obama administration wants to win the future, so it set up a new government agency to handle that.
The highway of government programs here is littered with carcasses of programs that were ill-conceived or ill-implemented, where large amounts of money have gone to firms, but very little innovation has come out of it.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The fate of innovation lies in the hands of governments. The story next time on Marketplace from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.